This is Lars. Thanks again for checking out my podcast. Enjoy your day and the show, and let's make America great again.
Ladies and gentlemen,
are you ready for the big show?
Right.
Exactly 15 seconds,
we'll
be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
You're a lime dog-faced pony soldier.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest, covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho.
There was nothing I saw at night that would be able to take Donald Trump out.
Honestly, provocative talk.
That is the normalization of lawlessness.
Your voice is beautiful. I've heard it for a long time.
On FM News 101 KXL.
I shredded his state of his mind address.
And now, here's your host.
The credulous boomer rube demo that backs Donald Trump.
Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Guess what? We're on remote. I love to get out of the studio, and now I'm about 50 miles from the Canadian border. In fact, I was just thinking, sitting here in the studios at KGMI, which is one of our great Radio Northwest affiliates, I'm here because there's a public gathering tonight, and believe it or not, they've asked me to come and speak to them. It's at a public school, and it's interesting. At least one of the subjects they've asked me about is Second Amendment, which, of course, is different in Washington State than it is in the state of Oregon. As I've told you many times, I carry a concealed weapon. I'm allowed to carry a concealed weapon in an Oregon school. I am not allowed to carry one in a Washington State school. That's something the legislature could fix. But, you know, the legislatures of Oregon and Washington these days are not inclined to go out and look out for the concerns of people who practice the Second Amendment. If anything, they're looking out for the concerns of the other folks, the folks like, the folks like Everytown, USA, you know, the group that Michael Bloomberg backs up. God forbid the Democrats choose him as their nominee. In any case, it is Conspiracy Theory Thursday from the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network. Today, the show live from our Bellingham affiliate, KGMI. And by the way, Western Washington University is in this town, and that always makes things just a little bit interesting because Western Washington is one of the most lunatic college campuses in the Northwest. But we actually don't have anything to say about them today. They haven't pulled off some stunts recently. I almost wonder if what happens is these kind of wackadoodle university campuses are a self-correcting phenomena. When the students act crazy enough, their parents see that and they say, you're not going there. And then enrollment drops. That's not just happened here in the Northwest. It's actually happened at college campuses around the country. That when alumni stop giving money, when parents stop sending their students, when students themselves say, I want to go to college to get an education. I'm not going there for the political activism, although on almost every college campus, you're going to get a certain amount of college activism. If you've decided you just want an education, that's probably the place you stay away from. Anyway, we've got a lot to talk about today. We're going to be talking to a member of the Oregon legislature who told me an amazing story. I'll cover it in the Northwest nonsense commentary coming up in about 15 minutes. But it has to do with who's actually running the show in Salem. And it seems that they're doing some of the Nancy Pelosi-style giant bill that nobody's read in a very, very short legislative session, which sort of means they're going to have to pass the bill to find out what's inside of it. And when that bill has something to do with the future of every single industry in Oregon, when it has to do with most of the jobs in Oregon, when it has to do with efforts to pull $700 million out of your pocket, you'd think that your representatives, if they're truly representing you, the voter, would be concerned about making sure that they know what's inside the bill. I'm going to tell you about one of the top Democrats in the Oregon legislature, since they run both sides of the aisle. They run both houses of the legislature. They run the governor's office. They run most of the statewide offices. Fact is, he had amendments that were introduced under his name and title, and last night he didn't even know he had done it. Now, you could put that off to dementia, because I think this particular lawmaker is a good candidate for dementia, but I think what really happened is he's not really running the show. I'll tell you who he is just a little bit later. Let me start with our Twitter poll. Late yesterday afternoon, I brought you Tim Iman on the show because a court decision came down yesterday in which a judge found that when you voted, if you voted in Washington State, you voted for $30 car tabs. Now, Oregon doesn't have the same system having to buy a new car tab to keep your car licensed every year. Their license fees are high enough, but Washington State's license fees are off the charts. So the voters, when we went to the polls, and I was one of them, who voted to have $30 car tabs, the voters have asked for this before. And not just ask, we have directed the state government that the cost of licensing your car, buying that little sticker that goes on your license plate, should not be one penny over $30 per year. Now, when the voters give an order, what does the government do? They salute and say, yes, sir. No, they don't. They look for any way they can to avoid doing what the voters have told them to do. And just remember, in America, government derives its powers from the consent of the governed. That's not just a fancy phrase from the Constitution and the Declaration. That is the idea this country was built on, that we have representatives. They are not there to be our nannies. They're not there to decide for us. They are there to follow our instructions, and especially at the state level, where the states of Oregon and Washington and Idaho all have constitutions that guarantee the public the right to make decisions, to make laws, to cancel laws, to cancel taxes, if you will. Well, the voters said, we want $30 car tabs. And what did the government do? They took your tax money and they went to court to fight it. And yesterday, surprisingly enough, a Seattle area judge actually decided the voters and the $30 car tab folks like Tim Iman were right and the government was wrong. But then he did something else. He also said, even though the government is wrong, I'm going to allow the government to keep on charging all of you the same old high rates, hundreds of dollars in some cases, to license a single car for a single year of driving on the public roads of Washington State. And that means that the government will have more time to go out and appeal this case. And believe me, they will appeal it all the way to the Washington Supreme Court in this case. So in the Twitter poll, I want to ask you this. Should Washington's leaders honor the $30 car tab vote or fight it in court? I vote for honor. We'll give you both opportunities. You can vote any way you like. But how could somebody, I would love to have a naysayer today call me up and say, well, if the voters tell the government to do something and the government thinks it's a bad idea, the government should have the prerogative to tell the voters to go jump in the lake, to go to hell and charge the fee anyway. I'd love to talk to a naysayer like that who actually makes that argument, because I don't think anybody actually believes that. I mean, even the liberals in government who want these piles and piles of cash, if they had to actually defend this idea in a debate and say why it makes sense for the government to tell the people what to do, if you believe in that, move to communist China. They're doing all kinds of terrible things to their population in the middle of this coronavirus outbreak, which, by the way, the new numbers on coronavirus infection, almost all of it in China, about 99% of the cases, more than 60,000 cases of coronavirus, 1,870 have died. Fortunately, America only has 14 cases because we've limited who comes into the country. I also want to bring this up. Should biological girls be forced to compete in athletics with biological boys? There's now a federal lawsuit that was filed that says girls who run track or compete in athletics should not have to run against biological males. Now, I called the Oregon School Activities Association. That's the sanctioning body for school, high school athletics. And I'm still waiting for the phone call back, and I'm not exactly holding my breath. In any case, glad to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday, live from Bellingham. Coming up in a moment in the Northwest Nonsense, I'm going to give you a couple of thoughts on where things are going here in the Northwest as they're going great guns in the rest of the country. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
Makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold, hard facts from Lars.
Well, by my estimation, the Northwest, Oregon, Washington, and perhaps Idaho as well, are in for a rough ride over the next 5 years. State governments enjoy record levels of tax revenue, mostly thanks to the Trump economy. Yet in both Oregon and Washington, lawmakers have laid on more billions of dollars in taxes. Now, I'm hearing from businesses already that have just begun running into the new Oregon corporate activity tax. In fact, some of you have sent me receipts saying, hey, when did we sign off on a sales tax? I thought we voted that down. And they're hearing from customers. How did a sales tax get added when voters have 9 different times rejected a sales tax in Oregon? The sales tax is hated just as much in Oregon as the income tax is in Washington. At the same time, in Washington state, lawmakers in Olympia are considering a measure to allow Seattle to impose an income tax. Again, the voters have said no to this. The state already has a tax in Washington state on business activity, and now it's going to tax the income generated by that already taxed business activity. Talk about double taxation. Oregon's governor is now pushing a carbon tax that will pull $700 million out of your pockets. And it's going to cause some industries like farming and logging and others that use energy to simply collapse. And with them, the jobs they support. Just last night, in the middle of a very short legislative session of 35 days, when they first set this aside, Oregon was a state where the legislature only met once a year. And then the lawmakers said, oh, gosh, we really need to meet twice a year. You know what happens when they meet twice a year? They get 35 days of legislative session, during which time each lawmaker gets $150-some a day in per diem. It's very, very lucrative for those lawmakers. Well, this session is supposed to be 35 days long. It was supposed to be to simply do readjustments on budgets, because trying to project out ahead 2 years in the future with what's called a biennial budget is very, very hard. So they said, you know, it'll just be for cleanup. Now they're trying to push major legislation through, including the carbon tax I've been telling you about. Now, if you listen to other media, you're going to hear it referred to as cap and trade. Nothing is capped. Nothing is traded. This is flatly a carbon tax. That's all it is. It does not change CO2 output one little bit. What it does do is lay $700 million in brand new taxes on top of the literally billions of dollars in taxes, billions of them, that were passed and added last year. And I know that when some of you see these things, you say, what's going on? Where do these taxes come from? Well, we tell you about them, and we say you got to call your state lawmaker and object to them. Anyway, in the middle of a very short legislative session that is supposed to only run 35 days, the climate folks, the folks pushing the carbon tax, including Kate Brown and the rest of her buddies, dropped, get this, an amendment. They put an amendment on the bill. Now, you might think when I say amendment, it's like a constitutional amendment. It's a few pages long, maybe. 177 pages of amendments to the bill. But then Senate President Peter Courtney talked to some lawmakers last night. Now, Courtney is supposed to be running the show in the Senate. And guess what? When he talked to those state lawmakers last night, he told them, when they said, what about this 177 pages of amendment? He said, what amendment? And they said, well, there's an amendment, 177 pages long, and it has your name on it. Peter Courtney said, I'm not aware of any amendments, including the massive one with his own name on it. It makes you wonder if the Senate president doesn't know who's submitting amendments to bills with his name on them. The question is, who's actually running the show down in Salem? From Twitter, hello, Lars. I just heard on the news that another state has decided to award electoral votes to the nationwide popular vote winner of the presidential election. Washington state is already part of this voter suppression movement. I'm surprised that this hasn't been challenged in court yet. There's nothing more than an aggressive attempt to circumvent the Constitution and nullify the will of the people, no matter which party they belong to. What are your thoughts on this? Signed, Bernie. Well, I got to tell you, Bernie, in some ways, I think it's going to turn out to be a joke. I think not only is Donald Trump going to win in November, I think there's a fairly good chance he's going to win the national popular vote. And wouldn't it be the best kind of comeuppance for liberal Democrats in Washington and Oregon if they agreed to be part of this national popular vote movement? Here's how it works. They said whoever wins the popular vote should get all of our electoral college votes. Well, unless a miracle gets pulled off, both Oregon and Washington's electoral votes will go to whoever the Democrats pick as their nominee, and they won't go to Donald Trump. But if the national popular vote movement is successful, it means that states that vote for, say, Bernie Sanders or Amy Klobuchar or whoever happens to win the nomination, it's probably not going to be Joe Biden at this point, that Donald Trump will get those electoral college votes, and it will turn all the Democrats and all the people pushing this foolishness about the national popular vote movement, it'll really humiliate them. And I think it couldn't happen to a nicer bunch of people. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
Well, you know, if you listen to this show, that I'm a big supporter of the police, but I say as long as they follow the rules. It appears that in West Lynn, the former police chief of West Lynn and some of his other officers did not follow the rules. District attorney's offices in Clackamas and Multnomah counties announced yesterday that they are reviewing actions taken by a group of West Lynn and Portland police officers in a racially motivated surveillance and arrest of a black Portland man, Michael Fessler, about 3 years ago. The Oregonian broke the big story, and I'll give them credit. They reported that Fessler's boss asked West Lynn officers to surveil and eventually arrest Fessler as a favor following a complaint of racial harassment in the workplace. When cops break the rules, they deserve to be called on the carpet. This man is no longer the chief of police in West Lynn, but that still deserves to be investigated. Secondly, the Washington Supreme Court has upheld a voter-approved measure that raises public transit funds in the Puget Sound area. This is the $54 billion expansion of so-called Sound Transit. I think it's insane. A group of voters went to court and they said, you put this on the ballot unconstitutionally. Well, the Washington Supreme Court, which is pretty well in the pockets of the labor unions, in a 7-2 decision today, has decided the motor vehicle excise tax is constitutional. So that's what you find out happens. The folks in government are going to back up the folks in government. From our best email of the day, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Lars, you can't believe people want to continue to live in places like Portland with additional taxes like the arts tax and the push for a homeless tax. The homeless should have a work program where they earn vouchers each day that would give them food or shelter if they work in Portland. Training should be provided to move the homeless forward to make a better life. Now, if they choose not to work, they have no resources provided at all. It's not a bad idea, Gary. I don't see it happening. Everybody will say, well, that's really mean to take somebody who has decided to live on the streets or decided to become addicted to drugs or decided to become addicted to alcohol. None of that is actually forced on you. But to say to them, you have to actually work and earn your keep, there are people who say that's just not fair. You got the Lars Larson Show.
Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails. I'm live today from Bellingham, Washington, just 50 miles from the Canadian border. Of course, Canada is where all the liberals are going to go after Donald Trump is reelected. It'd be fun to do a show from Peace Arch Park, just a bit from here in Blaine, Washington, and watch as all the liberals and their caravan of belongings head into Canada. But again, they promised to leave before, and they haven't actually come through on that promise. The Oregon legislature, as I told you, is in session right now. It is supposed to be a short session, 35 days. Lawmakers talked citizens into allowing them to do this a long time ago by saying, well, we can't just meet once a year. The budget has to be adjusted. So the short session election is supposed to be about doing some little housekeeping things and all that, not necessarily passing major legislation like this carbon tax at $700 million. State Senator Herman Bartschiger joins me now, who's a Republican. He represents the Grants Pass area. And, Senator, you're a good friend of the show. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, how are you doing today, Lars?
I'm doing very, very well, but it sounds like nobody knows who's running the show down there, because last night, tell me about the little amendment to this $700 million carbon tax that dropped in your lap last night.
Yeah, you know, you make an excellent point. The short session is obviously being abused by the Democrats as we fly through this session, the Oregonian state. It's very difficult for the average citizen to have a clue of what we're doing here. So last night at 6 o'clock, they dropped a 177-page amendment to this carbon tax bill, and they're going to vote it out of committee today at 3 o'clock.
Now, hold on. This begins to sound, Senator, like the Oregon legislature is going to have to adopt the Nancy Pelosi standard. We haven't actually read this thing. We don't in any way, shape, or form understand it, but we've got to vote on it and vote it through to find out what's inside it.
Exactly. I mean, think of this. So we've been in session for 2 weeks. We're in our second week. We've had lots of hearings on the cap and trade bill that was being proposed, or the carbon tax bill, which is probably a more appropriate name for it. And now, at the last minute, we're getting ready to vote this out of committee, and we're going to gut and stuff the bill with a whole new amendment that changes its just and vote it out of committee with nobody commenting on it. There will be no public comment today.
Now, I want you used a term there that I'm familiar with, but a lot of my audience may not be. Gut and stuff. I believe I know what it means, but I want you to explain it to them. What does it mean when you have a bill that people have had a chance to look at to some degree after a short session, and then you gut and stuff it? What does that mean?
That basically means that you just totally rewrite the bill. So there's a lot of things that you were looking at previously that aren't in there, and there's probably a lot of things in this particular case, it makes it worse.
Senator, there was a massive rally about a week ago, in which more than 1,000 trucks showed up in Salem, along with thousands of Oregonians who said, we do not want this $700 million carbon tax. It's going to destroy farming. It's going to destroy logging. It's going to do heavy damage to virtually every industry that uses energy or the public highways or transportation in any way, shape, or form. They said that. And you might think in the amendment they would have done something to address those concerns. Have they?
No. They put out a press release that they have, but when you read the bill that nobody else will have time to read, that's not true at all. They water some things down to the point that they do absolutely nothing, but yet they point to it and said that they've made some concessions. But they have not. In the grand scheme of things, it does nothing.
And just, Senator, so people understand it, because they're going to be dependent on the fake media, and they're going to read, well, they've made some changes to the bill to help out rural Oregon. Tell me if this isn't the proper way to interpret this. They want to put the $700 million carbon tax on. It applies to every form of energy under the sun, gasoline, diesel, electricity, natural gas, propane, every form of energy. And they say, but we're only going to have it apply in the big cities. It won't apply out in the boonies. And that's what they're going to say. Can they actually do that? And aren't they just planning to say, we're going to get this thing under, you know, we get the nose of the camel under the tent. And then once it's in place, all those rural folks are going to get slapped with the tax at some point down the road. And there'll be no way to beat it at that point.
Well, it's actually worse than that now, Lars. It's everybody's in west of the Cascades. So it's everybody is in west of the Cascades except Coos and Curry County. So that's Senator Roblin's district, and that's how they're going to get Senator Roblin to vote for it. Remember, last year, Senator Roblin did not vote for this. He actually killed the bill. So to entice him, they kicked his counties out. Now, here's another little thing, though. So as this thing goes along, a lot of the money will flow back to the counties. Once we get 23 counties that so we got all everything west of the Cascades are already in. I think that 17 counties are in. When we get to 23 counties that opt in, then the entire state automatically is in. Now, how do they get the other counties to opt in? Well, they're going to be money. They're going to be giving gifts from the treasury to all the counties that are in. The counties that are out don't get any money. And what do you think those commissioners are going to do in Eastern Oregon when they need a little money? They're going to opt in.
And by the way, to put a fine point on that, Senator, tell me if I'm wrong about this, because you're my sounding board on this. They're going to say to those counties, which are heavily timber-dependent or agriculture-dependent, they're going to say, yeah, you're sucking wind out there because agriculture and timber are on the ropes. So you're not like Portland. You don't have piles of lawyers and doctors and accountants and all that. So you don't have the money to run your county, to run even basic services, like Josephine County basically has no law enforcement. But if you want a little cash, all you've got to do is opt into Kate's carbon tax.
Absolutely. And then once they get 23 counties, excuse me, Lars, once they get 23 counties, then all the rest of the counties are automatically put in.
This is outrageous. Now, is this A, do they have the votes to pass it? And B, are the Republicans going to hold to their promise to the citizens to walk away from Salem and head for the hills to keep this vote from happening?
We're still dedicated to stopping this legislation. How we do that, I don't know. I don't want to give any specific time and dates and stuff, but we are dedicated to stopping this legislation.
All right. One last issue, because I think this is hugely important. There is a very flawed leader, and I faulted him for the sexual harassment that happened under his watch and everything else. The senator who is the Senate president is Peter Courtney. Now, this amendment, if I'm correct, was introduced by Peter Courtney. But when Peter Courtney called you at home last night to have a chat and you asked him about the amendment, what did he tell you?
He told me he knew nothing of the amendment.
So an amendment with his name on it, 177 pages long, that is essentially a brand new bill where they take everything that's in the current bill, they gut it out, and then they stuff it full of the new bill. It's in under Peter Courtney's name. And Peter Courtney, when he talked to you last night, an hour and a half after the amendment had already been formally introduced with his name on it, didn't know anything about it. What does that tell you?
It tells me that there's a lot of interesting things going on in this Capitol. I think it's going to get more interesting. I don't know who's in charge anymore, if anybody. Is this the influence by the Speaker of the House? So I don't know. President Courtney has been very ill. He is not in the building all day, all the time. And so I just kind of wonder what is going on. Hey, Lars, I want to back up a little bit.
Hold on a second. We got to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm going to carry Senator Bearchugger through. We'll talk to him on the other side. We'll get to your phone calls and emails. Live from Bellingham near the Canadian border with our KGMI affiliate, you've got the Lars Larson Show. Back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm live on remote today from Bellingham, Washington with KGMI, one of our great Radio Northwest affiliates. And I've been speaking with State Senator Herman Bearchugger, who is, he's telling us about an amendment to a bill introduced by the president of the Oregon State Senate. And the president of the Oregon State Senate last night, after the amendment had been introduced, knew nothing about it. And, Senator, you were about to mention something else to me, and I wanted to give you the time to do it, so I held you through the break. What's the addition you want to add?
Okay, two things, Lars. One, you know, we talk about the media. They have not done us any favors. We had the Timbre Unity Rally last Thursday. The place was full of people. We had 1,100 trucks. We know that for sure. The media said we had a little over 1,000 people. Well, Lars, we gave out 6,000 hot dogs that day. So I guess those 1,000 people were really hungry. But then it gets worse. the other day the environmentalists had their rally here, and I sat looked out my window and watched them march around the Capitol, and I got just a little over 300 people, but yet they had 1,000. So I don't know. They must not know how to count very well.
I don't think they do, and it's important that you make that mention. Couple of, I've already asked you if you're ready to walk out. You've indicated you're going to stop at one way or the other. A smaller sort of procedural issue is, are you going to demand that they read this entire bill aloud, which is allowed under your rules?
No, we're not going to let them. We're not going to demand that they read the bill because we won't be here to demand they read the bill.
Well, that's a good answer. You're not going to be there. So it's already reached that point where literally the Democrats have gone so far, and this is a partisan thing. Are there any Republicans who've crossed the aisle on this one?
No, I don't sense that in any way. Of course, this is an interesting building, and interesting things can happen, but right now I don't sense that at all. And you know, this issue with the timber companies with their debacle, that really made my life a lot more complicated, because immediately the Democrats thought that this was, the timber industry is our friends and this is so important to the timber industry that the Republicans are going to stick up for their friends. And what they basically said is, if you want your timber industry's pesticide bill to pass, you're going to have to stick around for cap and trade, and we just simply can't do that. So the timber industry didn't do us any favor. I don't know who was advising them politically, but I would give them their walking papers.
Because the horse trading that they did, it didn't appear the industry got anything except maybe excused from some of the lawsuits that the environmental groups have said, we promised not to do it. And when I talked to Andrew Miller from Stimson Lumber on the air yesterday, I said, well, there are a certain number of groups that have promised not to sue. But there's 1,001 environmental groups out there. Any one of them can bring a lawsuit. Just because a few of them promised not to sue, that doesn't get you free and clear. And he admitted that that was true. So, and having haven't we seen that same thing before with the Clinton Forest deal back in the 90s when they said, look, we've worked out a compromise between the industry and the environmentalists. And then the folks who weren't at the environmentalist table, the ones who didn't take part, just said, well, we'll sue instead. They're all ideological brothers anyway, aren't they?
Oh, they listen, their goal, you know, you have a certain percentage of our population that just simply believes that humans are a detrimental force to the planet. And they've never wavered from that. They've never wavered for any of their positions. So what makes you think they're going to waver from them now? This is just a pause. They're going to get something, regroup, change organizations. People are going to shift around, and they're going to come right back out. As soon as they start seeing helicopters flying, they believe that it is raining down death. That hasn't changed. I just think it was the stupidest thing I've ever seen in my life.
I would have to agree with you. Senator, just stick with it. If you need a place to flee to, you can always come to my house in Vancouver, Washington. We'll get you safely across the border, and we'll hold off the law if they come to try to haul you back.
All right. Thanks, Lars. Take care.
Thanks very much. That's Senator Herman Bertschinger. You know, I made the mention of people living on the streets. Brandy is on the phone now, listening on the Radio Northwest Network. And, Brandy, you told my producers that you have no option other than living on the street. I want to hear what you have to say.
Yes, I feel like a whole group of us are just left out of this. You know, everybody puts it as, you know, just technically homeless and you belong there, or it's like this instant judgment. So I am on SSI. I am not allowed to work at all, or I will lose my SSI. I can do volunteer work, but nothing that would pay me.
What is your disability? Because we're close to the break, I'm going to interrupt you for a moment. Okay. What is your disability? How are you disabled? Because you're talking to me on the phone, and there are jobs that involve that.
I have I have 7 bulging discs in my neck, and also have I have like 4 different types of arthritis. I was in bad car accidents that end up just making weak spots that arthritis took over. So I've had 3 different worker comp cases for aggravation of existing. So therefore, I was not able to get jobs anymore because I'm a risk. So it took me 7 years to fight to even get SSI. Meanwhile, you can't work. And then I've been on SSI since 2017. I cannot afford any housing because they want three times the income. I can't even get on the application list. I still have, you know, car insurance. My stuff is in a storage unit, so I have a $100 storage unit. I have phone bill. And most of my money goes into food because when you're on SSI or Social Security, you usually do not qualify for very many food stamps. I'm only allowed anywhere from $18 to $56, and I still have to pay for part of my prescriptions.
You know what, Brandy? I want to talk to you again on First Amendment Friday.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
You're a lying dog-faced pony soldier.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest, covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho.
There was nothing I saw at night that would be able to take Donald Trump out.
Honestly, provocative talk.
That is the normalization of lawlessness.
Your voice is beautiful. I've heard it for a long time.
On FM News 101 KXL.
I shred at his state of his mind address.
And now, here's your host.
The credulous boomer rube demo that backs Donald Trump.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Today I'm on remote. I'm at one of our affiliate stations, which we do all the time. The Radio Northwest Network serves the Pacific Northwest, all the way from Bellingham, which is where I am today, down to Southern Oregon and even into Northern California, and all the way from the Oregon coast, well into Idaho. We're glad to serve this region with honestly provocative talk. And it's Conspiracy Theory Thursday. If you'd like to join in with the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're on hold, we'll get to your calls. 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our Twitter poll today, should Washington's leaders, in this case it's Washington State, honor the $30 car tab vote by citizens, or should they fight it in court? I would say they should honor the vote. But instead, state government has chosen to take taxpayer money and take the case to court and say, we don't want to do what the $30 car tab vote tells us to do. Well, already a judge has said that vote was a legal vote. The judge also kept his injunction in place, so state government doesn't have to start honoring the vote yet. They're being given a little bit of time to decide if they want to appeal it. But I just want you to imagine this situation the way I see it, and that is, you have a government that derives its authority to govern from the consent of the governed. Now, I know that's old language. It goes back to the Constitution and the Declaration, but I've always held it near and dear. Because if I say to my representatives, to the governor of whatever state I live in, if I say you have the right to govern because we consent to let you govern, but we also want the right to pass our own laws when you won't do it, to rescind laws that you've passed because we don't agree with them. That is in the constitutions of the Northwest states. You have the right to initiative and referendum. And yet and still, when the voters go out, citizens go out and gather the signatures, and it's a gigantic task. It usually costs more than $1 million in cash, even with a lot of volunteers, to get a single ballot measure on the ballot. The first thing those government agencies do is they say, we're going to use your money to fight you in court and say we don't have to do what you just told us to do. Now, I think that's such an un-American idea that the representatives of the people would tell the people, go to blazes. We're not going to follow your instructions. We're not going to do what you say. So I would say they should honor the $30 car tab vote. And the same thing is true in Oregon. Oregon citizens passed a death penalty. And then the state legislature said, we're going to take it away without a vote of the people. And I might mention, there's a trial going on right now. Jeremy Christian is on trial for stabbing two men to death on a Max Light rail train. And when you hear the gruesome nature of that crime, you know that if he is found guilty, he should be the prime candidate for the death penalty. And at the time he committed his crime, the death penalty was on the books. And then the state legislature took it off the books, effectively ruled it out. It is technically still on the books, but it would take such an extreme set of circumstances that I think I can safely predict nobody in Oregon will ever be given the death penalty again. Now, if you don't like the death penalty, I understand that. But do you like representative government? Do you think the people have the right to make the laws? And when they say to the government, we want the death penalty, and a majority of Oregonians, and a majority of Washingtonians, and a majority of people who live in Idaho believe in the death penalty, your elite government representatives do not. And they have said to you, you no longer have the right to make these decisions. In fact, it'd be interesting to see what would happen if you ask the people who are running for re-election right now, do you support the right of initiative and referendum? And if the voters vote for something, should you do it? And if the voters vote against something, will you agree as a representative not to do it? And if you don't tell me yes, then I'm not going to vote for you. I think that's a great test of a representative. Let's go to Sharon in Seattle. Sharon, I take it you're calling in about the young lady, Brandy, who called in and said she's living on the street because she is disabled. She gets SSI disability, and she says she is not able to work at any job whatsoever, and she's not on the street by choice. What would you tell her? Sharon? Well, Sharon apparently decided to hang up. She's not paying attention to her phone in any case. Let me go to Jim in Puyallup. Hey, Jim, welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Good afternoon, Lars. I'm actually sitting in my office. I work for the Social Security Administration. And Brandy is, I would love to be her advisor because we have a ticket to work program for both SSI and SSD recipients that allows them to work in any job that they can do for up to 9 months and still receive not only their full pay but their full benefits at the same time.
So when you say for nine months, would that work if I decided to work a half-time job or a three-quarter-time job 12 months of the year? Yeah, in other words, is it 9 months no. full-time or the equivalent in no, part-time? Yes?
No, it's 9 months for an actual time period.
I see.
It doesn't matter if you're a part-time, three-quarter-time, full-time, double-time. Doesn't matter. You have the ability to work on that program for up to 9 months before we will actually stop giving you benefits. And if for some reason, say 6 months later, her disability does not allow her to do that job, she can stop doing that job, report it to us, and when she does go and get another job, she will have another 9 months after that to be able to do another job and still get her benefits.
So that means she could go out and she could find gainful employment. I know she has disc problems and all this. I don't know all the details, but the fact that she was talking to me on the phone, Jim, my first reaction when people say I can't work and they're talking to me on the phone is, well, if you're talking on the phone, there are jobs doing that. There's a nice young lady named Tricia who works at our front desk, and that's what she does all day long, is answer the phones. There are telemarketing jobs. Now, they're not the highest paying jobs in the world, but they pay more than minimum wage, and you can do that job. You can often do it from your own home. And don't you work with people who are SSI disability recipients who do exactly that? They find a way to make a living by working in a way that doesn't interrupt their SSI disability and also doesn't, you know, that they can physically still do despite their disability. That's true, isn't it?
Oh, every single day, and we're so proud of them, too. You know, they are not willing to, you know, take no for an answer, and that's commendable all by itself. And, you know, what I didn't get a chance to say is, she can use this program in where she gets a full-time job up to 8 months and then stops and says, I can't do it. And a month later starts another job. She can do that five times over before she's no longer eligible for the Ticket to Work program. So it is not that she cannot get a job. It is not that the Social Security Administration will cut off her benefit. She's either misinformed or just plain doesn't want to do it.
And I would guess one of the two is probably true. I can't prejudge her and say, well, she just has decided she doesn't want to work. But it would seem to me that what you've just suggested is the right way out. And maybe you get into that job for 9 months and find out I can actually do this and I can get myself off disability. And that would be a positive thing for anybody. Live in Bellingham today for Conspiracy Theory Thursday. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Lars Larson Show on FM News 101.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to tell you about a story. This is a Northwest story, and it involves a horrendous crime that was committed against a young lady. And I know that people are going to immediately say, because of this man's surname, is he legally in the country? Because you know that in the Pacific Northwest, given the population of illegal aliens and the population of Latinos, there's about a 50-50 chance. I will tell you that I have checked, and this man is a citizen. But it involves a 51-year-old Uber driver who's in custody in the Jackson County Jail for allegedly sexually assaulting a female passenger that he picked up early on Sunday morning. Medford police put out the word that Antonio Gonzalez Salinas faces, get this, felony charges of first-degree kidnap, first-degree sexual abuse, first-degree rape. He's facing an additional misdemeanor charge of public indecency. What happened was the victim in this case, a 21-year-old, had been downtown, a young lady, in Medford with a group of friends on Saturday night. They had had some drinks, and her friends thought she needs a ride home. So they sensibly called an Uber to take her to another friend's house in Medford. And this guy shows up at 129. We know he's an Uber driver. We know he picked her up. Now, whether or not he committed the crime, that has to be determined in a court. He has a chance to, go to court and face the charges. He picked her up at 1:29 in the morning. He's accused of kidnapping her and then raping her along with other charges. And it just makes me wonder, when somebody is an Uber driver, your employer, if they've done the proper background check on you, they know exactly who you are. They have a picture of your picture ID. They know what kind of car you drive. They know where you live. They know everything about you. If you commit a crime, he's accused at this point, not convicted, then how in the world do you expect to get away with committing a crime? If you commit a crime and they're able to place you where you were, they're able to connect you to the victim, they're able to show where you were supposed to pick her up, where you were supposed to drop her off. Now, the charge, the accusation could be false. I mean, the guy has a chance to confront the case in court, and the state has to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. But because when I first heard about Uber and Lyft, I thought, well, this is good, because if you have a full background check on the driver, if you know if he has a criminal record or not, and he knows that you know exactly who he is. I mean, in all likelihood, they have his social security number, his date of birth, a picture of him, the whole nine yards, and then you decide if he really did commit a crime, to commit a crime knowing that the police will be able to immediately put you at the scene of the crime and connect you to the victim, it seems like an especially crazy thing to do. But then again, we hear about criminals doing crazy things all the time. Kevin's on the line from Bellingham, where I happen to be doing the show today, because I'm going to a public event tonight where they've asked me to speak. Hey, Kevin, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
How's it going, Rod? Lars?
Yes, Kevin.
My question is, because we see what the Democrats are doing regarding the Second Amendment, they're push.
Yep.
You just have to look at Virginia for that. Where do we draw the line in the sand?
Well, I think the line needs to be
back.
The way you push back is you elect different people to the legislature, or in the states like Oregon, Washington, Idaho, you put a citizen initiative on the ballot to protect Second Amendment rights. You also pay attention to who your sheriff is, because there are some sheriffs in this country who have said, if you adopt unconstitutional laws that violate the constitutional rights of my constituents. Sheriffs are tied directly to the voters. The voters choose sheriffs. The voters can fire sheriffs. So there are sheriffs who will stand up for the constitutional rights of citizens. There are, unfortunately, also some sheriffs who will stand up for illegal alien lawbreakers and other folks who are breaking the law. But those are several ways you can go about it. You also have to do this. Every single one of the Democrat candidates for president is anti-gun, and they are openly and unabashedly anti-gun. So if any one of those people gets the nomination and gets elected president, you can, and if the Democrats win majorities in the House and Senate, you can kiss your gun rights goodbye. Because I think they've finally got to the point where they're, and if it's Mike Bloomberg, who has billions of dollars, $60 billion or so, and he says he's willing to spend several billion to buy the presidency, if he gets elected, kiss your gun rights goodbye. So this is where we sit right now, Kevin. Kevin, thank you very much. I appreciate your phone call. It sounds like Kevin's checked out of the conversation, but I appreciate the call from Bellingham. Let me go to Brahim. Hey, Brahim, you heard that young lady call me up and say, I'm not on the streets by choice. I'm on SSI disability, and I'm not allowed to work. And then you probably heard the man from Puyallup who called in, who works with the SSI, the disability arm of Social Security, who said she most certainly can work, and there's a way for her not only to work, but to work jobs to the point where she finds a job that might support her instead of disability, and she could work her way right out of disability if she chose to.
Yeah, I want to get to a quick couple of things. First of all, Brandy, she sounds a lot better than a lot of telemarketers I talk to. She sounded really good.
At least she's in this country.
And her accent is excellent. She sounds like an American. So I love dealing with her. She's awesome. Anyway, the next thing is a lot of people protect their income. A personal friend of mine who used to work where I work, and he was making $2,200 a month or so, he quit doing his job because he had SSI and food stamps. And he said, if I work anymore, I lose my money. Well, I found out from him he was getting like $900 a month. He called me up and said, I'm not surviving. I said, go back to work. I talked him into it. He is forgetting the $900. Now he's making $2,500 a month. And he's feeling better about himself because he's earning a dang paycheck.
And every dime he has is his. Now, listen, Brahim, I don't understand why. You know, and I understand SSI disability, the average payment, I think, is $700 or $800. So your friend was getting a little. Well, now imagine this. In Oregon and Washington, if you've got a minimum wage, where is it now? $12-13 an hour.
Whatever.
Times 160 hours a month, just full-time work or two part-time jobs, and you are so much better off. You're almost grossing $2,000 a month, and then you say, well, how does $2,000 a month compare to $900? I'd rather have the $2,000 a month job. And you wonder, are the folks at Social Security, the man from Puyallup sounds like he's the kind of guy who would encourage you to go out and do it. But, Brahim, I want to point something out to you. An awful lot of state and federal bureaucracies work their tails off to get people signed up for benefits, and they don't exactly encourage them to get off. This guy in Puyallup sounds like he was one of the good guys, but they're not all good guys.
Lars, everyone likes a little money once in a while handed to them, but honestly, I feel so much better when I get a check that I earned, when I look at something I've created. It's just so much better for your morale. It's crazy.
Well, I want to tell you something, Brahim. I made minimum wage for a long time working in this business. I now make a fabulous paycheck. I mean, I'm not ashamed of it. And that's one important thing. When you get the money that you've earned yourself, you never have to feel guilty about it. And I occasionally have people who email or Facebook or Twitter, or they call the show, and they want me to feel guilty. And I say, I earn my keep. I generate enough revenue for my employers that they're happy to pay me a fabulous salary. But you never have to be ashamed of that. Now,
nope.
I'm not saying that everybody who's on public support should be ashamed. I'm not saying that. That'd be too much of a blanket statement. But if you're capable of working and earning your own keep, and it did sound like Brandy could do an office job, could work as a telemarketer, could do a number of jobs that wouldn't necessarily put a strain on her back, it would make her more money, and she could be proud of the check she cashes. And as far as I'm concerned, if you're capable of working, you don't. You ought to be ashamed.
Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. When somebody mentions drones to you, you likely think of either the kids' toys that you might be buying, or you might think of some of the drones that are used the bigger ones to drop hellfire missiles, you know, the ones the Democrats don't want Trump doing, but the ones they didn't have any objection to Barack Obama using for literally thousands of missile strikes. Yeah, those. But do you think of police agencies using drones? It's happening. And I think it's a good idea, and I thought I'd test that out on our friend Bernie Giusto, who is both a former sheriff and a former police chief, and so he knows his stuff. He's retired now, so he doesn't have a dog in the fight, which means he's free to talk. Bernie, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks, Lars.
So do you like the idea of drone use by police agencies at the local level? Sacramento is one good example where they've already been using them to find people who've taken people hostage, or maybe even to get more information, more real-time data for people on the ground, officers on the ground who are facing a hostage situation. Sounds like a good idea to me.
And the use of the drone really is what the question comes down to for me. And in this case, we're talking about micro drones. I think some people still imagine the drones are as big as maybe a model aircraft. But the drones we're talking about in the situation in Sacramento, which are used for internal search of a building, were as big, smaller than your fist. So obviously they are not invisible, but they're harder to detect, especially from a distance. So they good for that kind of surveillance. And technology is someplace that law enforcement always finds itself trying to catch up. But the worst, the most challenging part of that is making sure what we intend their use is, what the use is around policy and good case law. So let's say that the drones are used for, in the case of Sacramento, really a good situation in a safe arrest of somebody who'd taken a hostage at a building. That's tremendous use. The policy still should be developed. The policy still should be followed, and the policy all should be evaluated and reevaluated and changed if necessary. Where sometimes we get a little bit anxious to serve our interests a little better is to expand that use. So let's say we decide we're going to use those drones inside to get information, not to end a hostage situation, or maybe even to before a search warrant served to protect the police officers, but maybe to before the search warrants developed to gain information about in somebody's house, in a building, in a warehouse, someplace that is pre the charge, pre the determination by the court, and pre a warrant, and then we deploy that drone in there. Well, here's where the policy's got to be carefully developed and not prohibited, but it's certainly got to be tested against good police practice.
Well, I would go with that, but for instance, let me try something more pedestrian. You know that when you were a police chief and when you were a sheriff, you knew that there were, say, drug deals going down in certain parts of the city. And I'll bet officers, your deputies and your officers figured ways, if I sit right here, there are guys who like to sell dope over on that corner. If I sit out of sight, I can sit and watch, and then if they start doing a deal, I can roll up on them, or what appears to be a deal, and I may be able to catch them in the act. Imagine if you could do that same watching from 100 feet up, out of sight, still legal, the people are out in public. Would you have any objection to using a drone that way, an eye in the sky, that would allow an officer to watch, and when he sees the kind of activity that he knows is signature for drug dealing, he says, now I'm going to roll up on these guys, and I've already seen them doing it, but I did it from out of sight. Would that be okay?
Well, let's see, we have two or three questions here, and so it depends where we're going to use a drone, on a public place, on a street, in a park. Yeah, I might be able to go along with that. I'd still want to see a policy. But the courts are starting to differentiate between where we use technology and how we use technology. So you know that we can't enter a property because we think maybe there's a stolen motorcycle.
I agree. Under. Yep.
And so
you can't even go up on the drive. You can't even go up on the driveway. That famous case I think you're referring to, where an officer saw a motorcycle that he thought was the motorcycle they were looking for, but it was covered with a tarp. So he walked up on the driveway, private property, but generally open to the public. But you know, where if I was walking down the street and walked onto somebody's driveway, nobody would object to it. But the officer went up, looked under the tarp, said, "Sure enough, that's the bike we've been looking for." And then the court said, "No, no, no. You were on somebody's property. You looked under the tarp, you violate the rights," right?
That's correct. And so the technology question isn't whether it has some value. It's that the technology doesn't get ahead of the policy and accepted practice and case law before we set some very difficult parameters to overcome later for the use of what's very important in terms of the future of law enforcement and its technology across the board.
You know, the other thing I wanted to ask you about, one of the most dangerous things cops do other than domestic violence is high-speed chases. And they're dangerous for the officer. They're also dangerous to the public. What if an officer knew, there's a guy who's rabbiting on me, and I think he's going to run away. I'll call in, and dispatch will send the drone we've got orbiting up above to follow that car. Then we can follow him from the air. We can vector, you know, cars in on the person, and we don't have to go 100 miles an hour down a neighborhood street and put people's lives at risk. Doesn't that sound like that'd be a legitimate use? Again, you're dealing with things happening in public.
Yes, I think it would be. And it always would always... what always comes first is the policy, the training, the evaluation process, and then the practice, that the practice comes before. Yes, there's no problem in that, except that at some point we don't want to run into problems with FAA regulations and how we're deploying the drones. And that kind of thing is just necessary to make it right, to end up with a really broad-based use of technology like drones. And it's coming whether we like it or not. And the court decisions around that would be very critical law enforcement in terms of what kind of breadth of freedom they have to use those things, and we don't want to start that case law.
Well, you know what I could think of, Bernie? That when you talk to pilots who fly coast to coast, they say, you know, air traffic control put them in what they call a tuna can. That is, the plane's flying along at a certain altitude, and for a mile or two, front and back and to each side and 1,000 feet top to bottom, that's your little tuna can of air that you're flying through. You know, generally over populated areas, my understanding from the helicopter pilots, they're not supposed to go below about 1,500 feet, except in emergencies and unless they're taking off or landing. Well, if you could develop, again, a policy that said police agencies can use drones, but we want you to limit yourself to the drones will fly no higher than 500 feet above ground, you know, in those areas. And if they know within the Portland Metro, Seattle Metro, Spokane Metro, that all the drones that might be used by the police will be, you know, between ground level and 500 feet, there aren't going to be any aircraft in that can, or if there need to be, air traffic control say, Portland police, move your drones out of the area. We have an aircraft that needs to fly over a city at 500 feet, which isn't going to happen very often.
Yeah, I think that's probably a good way to put it, Lars, in terms of those kind of controls. So the other thing we have to overcome is the politics of what so-called leadership in these cities that prevent law enforcement from trying new things. And sometimes law enforcement breaks on themselves, but in the end, that needs to be as much as a political sell as otherwise. So the Sacramento PD chief, I think Chief Hans is named, he made this known how they used it, and they used it in a situation where life was saved, probably in the interest of both law enforcement, the hostage, and maybe the suspect. So those are the kind of things where we start to lay good base work.
I mean, imagine this, Bernie. I know that when your guys get called on a call of a hot burglary in a warehouse or some big building somewhere, and that officer has to walk into a big, dark building, and he realizes he is nothing but a target, and if the bad guys see him coming or her coming, that officer's life could very much be at risk. I'd much sooner put a $200 drone in there that can quietly whisper in there, avoid obstacles, and look for the bad guys, rather than send in either a canine or send in the officer himself or herself. I'd much prefer to see that happen. You lose a $200 drone, no big deal. You lose a canine or God forbid, a human officer, very bad idea. Bernie Giusto is a former sheriff and former police chief. Bernie, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. We'll be back in just a moment. Glad to get your phone calls and emails. And I want to tell you about an idea that my colleague John Carlson brought up called Democrat for a Day. I'm going to get behind it. And you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday, live today from our affiliate station, KGMI, in Bellingham, Washington, because I was invited up to speak to a group tonight, and that should be a lot of fun. But KGMI was nice enough, and they've done this before, to let me use one of their studios, and I'm glad for it. So I'm here in Bellingham tonight. I'll be back in studio for tomorrow's First Amendment Friday. Our Twitter poll today, should Washington's leaders honor the $30 car tab vote or fight it in court? So far, state government has decided to fight the citizens and fight their vote in court, even though they just lost one round where a judge rejected most of the challenges to the $30 car tabs. But the 30 the The current prices are still in effect because the judge said, I'm going to keep my injunction in place. That gives the state time to decide to appeal. And I guess what I'd be asking, every one of you asking your state lawmakers, how dare you spend even more of our money to appeal a case where you want to tell the voters to go jump in a lake? You know, you want to tell the voters, you voted for this, we're not going to do it, and we will use your own money to fight you in court. So is it honor the $30 card tab vote or fight it in court? I vote for honor. Start asking your state lawmakers, will they vote for honor as well? Now, there's another idea, and I and my friends will tell you, I'm the first to borrow a good idea, although I like to give lavish credit to the to the source of the idea. And I was talking to my friend John Carlson, who does the morning show on our affiliate KVI in Seattle. And I drove right past him. He was asleep when I drove past Seattle last night on my way to Bellingham. But John suggested an idea that I think is great. And it's not complicated, and anybody can do it. When Washington's primary election comes up in March, full and lavish credit to John for this idea. John wants to sponsor Democrat for a Day. All of us Republicans, and I'm one of them, who are voters in Washington State, can cross the line because of the primary system in Washington State and vote for a Democrat candidate in the primary. And if you say, no, 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 Lars, I'm going to give my vote to Donald Trump. Trump's already got the nomination sewn up. So if we cross the line, as John suggested, and vote for our favorite Democrat candidate. In this case, that would be Bernie Sanders, because having a full-on communist running against the capitalist Donald Trump with the kind of success behind Donald Trump that he has, both in his private business affairs before the presidency and in his performance as president, versus Bernie Sanders, who's never had a real private sector job in his life. He has worked for the government, and for the government all he's done his whole life, and he doesn't even have that much to show as having been a former member of Congress or senator that he can point to it and say, well, I managed to make this happen or that happen. He's basically collected a government paycheck for decades and not delivered much of anything. So I think having those two have Bernie Sanders finish off very well in Washington State, we could all be Democrats for a day, and full and lavish credit to my friend John Carlson. I love the idea. In fact, tomorrow, I'm going to ask, I think on the Twitter poll tomorrow, I'm going to ask, do you think it's a good idea to be a Democrat for a day and vote for the candidate who Donald Trump is most likely to be able to beat, and it offers Americans a choice? Would you like full-blown communism, or would you like full-blown capitalism? Which one will work out better for you and your family? Framing it up that way, America will have one of the clearest choices this fall that this country has ever seen. I mean, we've had people who've been a little bit to the left. We certainly have Looney Tunes like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, but we have never had a full-blown presidential election based on communism versus capitalism. Let's go to Stacy. Hey, Stacy, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
I had a little bit of an issue with Brandy, the one that has a bulging disc. And
yeah, just so everybody else knows what she said. Brandy called in and said, I'm living on the street and not through my own choice. I'm on disability. I can't work, or I can't work because I'm afraid I'll lose my disability. What should I do? And as has been pointed out, John from Puyallup called in, who works for Social Security. He says she can work. She can go out and try out four or five different jobs for up to three quarters of a year each time. She can make money and not lose her disability. And then I would hope what John didn't say, but what I'll add, is when you're disabled, she has disc problems and other issues. When she finally finds that job, says, heck, I could do this job on an ongoing basis, you could get off disability altogether. What do you think about that?
Well, here's my deal. Lars, right now, you know what I'm doing? I'm changing a windshield on a car.
That's your job.
That's my job. I fell three stories down an elevator shaft 10 years ago. I broke every bone in my body from my armpits down.
Wow.
Yeah. My doctor didn't think I was going to walk. I lost 60% mobility in my leg. And right now, I am out here in the cold working.
Yeah.
When they cleared me,
And let me ask you something, Stacey. You're working even though it probably hurts. I mean, I know everybody says it hurts to go
every
to work.
Day.
But it hurts every day, but you go out and you earn your own paycheck.
Every single day, Lars.
I was on opiates for 2.5 years, and I was thankful. I was blessed to have a doctor that took me off of them and monitored me for weeks at a time to get me off of them and educated me on all that stuff. But at the same time, like, I'm a single dad. I have an 11-year-old boy that looks up to me that I have to support and care for. And I get up every morning at 6:30 a.m. and leave for my work, and I work until my work is done. And
can
my
you
job
imagine,
is not easy.
I bet it's not.
Not easy.
It's, that's a physical job. But can you imagine the example? Imagine the example you're setting for your boy, because he can tell his friends.
Oh, absolutely.
My dad fell 3 stories. He got hurt badly. He still gets up every single day and turns in a full day of work.
Quiet, please. Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
You're a line dog-faced pony soldier.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest, covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho.
There was nothing I saw at night that would be able to take Donald Trump out.
Honestly, provocative talk.
That is the normalization of lawlessness.
Your voice is beautiful. I've heard it for a long time.
On FM News 101 KXL.
I shred at his state of his mind address.
And now, here's your host.
The credulous boomer rube demo that backs Donald Trump.
Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. And if you wonder why I'm mentioning our affiliate KGMI, anytime someone is willing to loan me a studio for the use for the day so that I can then go and attend a public meeting tonight, and they've invited me to speak, and no, I don't take a paycheck from that. I get paid well enough already. I'm happy just to come up here. A little bit of a drive. Although one thing I do notice, when I drive around the state of Oregon, don't see too many state cops. I wish they would add some more state cops. Not because I don't like going 5 miles an hour over the speed limit, but frankly, on the Washington State highways, I drove I-5 last night. It's about 4.5 hours from Portland all the way to Bellingham. But I saw lots of state cops. There was quite a presence. And in a lot of ways, that's very reassuring. In fact, there was a terrible accident. I saw a little bit of it, and then I saw it in the news this morning on Interstate 5 along the area I drove, although the accident was in the southbound lanes, and I was in the northbound lanes, of course. Tonight, I'll be in the southbound lanes. But it's reassuring to know the cops are there. It's dismaying, to use a fancy word for it, to know that in some places like the state of Oregon, the number of state cops is barely adequate to do the job. And I know, I've heard all the rap on cops. I don't like getting tickets. Well, if you don't like getting tickets, don't go more than 5 miles an hour over the speed limit, and you'll be just fine. I got this email, and I want to share it with you because it's one of the concerns I have about what government is doing to people. The Pacific Northwest, for the most part, has a crying need for housing. Now, that's not just dealing with people on the street. I love it when these politicians say, the reason that heroin addict is living in a tent on the streets of Seattle or Spokane or Portland or Eugene is because he's short, the housing prices have gone up. And I'd love to ask one of those politicians, so you think that guy living in a tent shooting heroin in his arm every day has $1,100 for rent, but he doesn't have it because average rents have gone to $1,300, that he's just $200 short? Come on, he doesn't have if he had $1,100, he'd be shooting in his arm right about now. No, this is not about the cost increases, but politicians have tried to use that logic. Why, the reason so many people are homeless is because housing costs went up 10 or 15%. That's the marketplace. Do you know how to bring housing costs down? Get the government out of the ridiculous level of regulations that they're proposing. I told you yesterday that I heard from a gentleman who said he wanted to build a house on part of the lot that his house sits on, keep the old house, rent it out, live in the new house. And he has, I think, a quarter acre of land, so he has enough land to do it. Well, guess what? In the state of Oregon, they have literally said, we want to end single-family zoning. That is, neighborhoods anywhere in the state that say this is a neighborhood of single-family homes. And I don't see anything wrong with single-family homes. I don't see anything wrong with apartment complexes, too. But to effectively say, You can't have any more single-family home neighborhoods. You can only have apartment building and duplex and triplex and sixplexes, and that's all you're going to get. And we're all going to live in little teeny boxes. I've lived in little teeny boxes at various times in my life. Tina and I lived on a sailboat for a couple of years. That was about 100 square feet. Our first home was a floating home. It was 700 square feet. So we know what it's like to live in a small space, and it's a choice. But it ought to be a choice, not one forced on you by the government that says you can't have a house with a front yard and a backyard. And that's really what they're trying to do. So when I got this email from Dan Hillman, who's out in Cheney, Washington, it really rang a bell. He said, Lars, I serve on the Planning Commission in Cheney, and several bits of legislation in Olympia would take a lot of land use control away from local governments and give it to Olympia. Please note, Senate Bill 6617 removes occupancy limits. I wonder what the fire marshal has to say about this. He says Senate Bill 6536, mandatory rezoning of single-family neighborhoods. The bill mandates cities to eliminate single-family zoning. The bill requires all cities with a population of 15,000 or more to allow duplexes through sixplexes, stacked flats, townhouses, and courtyard apartments in areas that are currently single-family zones that are within a half a mile of a major transit stop. So now all of a sudden, whether or not you have an apartment building built next to your house in what you thought was a single-family neighborhood is dependent on how close it is to a light rail stop or to a bus line. House Bill 2570, auxiliary dwelling units. Now, I've told you before, I'm a fan of auxiliary dwelling units as a choice of the homeowner. He says this bill requires that all cities with a population of 2,500 or more adopt ordinances and develop regulations allowing at least one ADU on all single-family lots. I'm not that troubled by that one. He says, but troubling, the bill outlines prescriptive do's and don'ts on how cities can write their regulations and set fees. And then 6617, that's a Senate bill, ADUs. The city requires all cities to create or update their ADU regs. The proposal prohibits cities from requiring off-street parking for ADUs within a half mile of a major transit stop. Do you know what that is? That's saying that if you had a neighborhood where everybody in the neighborhood decided to put an auxiliary dwelling unit in the backyard. Now, I've told you, I'm a fan of ADUs. I call them mother-in-law houses. That's not an impolite term. My mother-in-law lives in the ADU that Tina and I built. And there's nothing, and in fact, my father-in-law lives in the house because she lets him live with her. So, very convenient. But saying we're going to take all off-street parking requirements away, so in other words, when you add another 30 or 40 people into a neighborhood, all of whom, if they're adults, are likely to have automobiles, they're going to try to force you onto the bus by saying you can add all that housing, but you don't have to add any parking. Now, that's crazy. And mandating this stuff from Olympia seems especially crazy. Let me go to a naysayer, though, in Bonnie Lake. Let me go first to Russ. Russ, what do you and I disagree about today? Hi.
I don't disagree. I agree with you most of the time. I want to know how many legislators you called on the $30 cabs.
I don't have to call any. My state lawmaker is a sensible person, but why I call them by getting on the radio, I call them out over 20 radio stations blanketing all three states. Do I need to do more than that?
Well, I would call them. I mean, you have a representative. You're being hypocritical if you want us
no,
to call.
No, I'm not. No, I'm not. Russ, I'm doing... I expect everybody to do the most effective thing they can with their time. I think that when I spend time on the radio talking about this and communicating to about a million people in the Pacific Northwest every day, I'm getting a lot of word out to lots of people. But when people call me, as the gentleman did that you're talking about, and say, Lars, what can we do? I say, pick up the phone and call your state rep. I don't think it's being hypocritical. If I'm calling a million people, including state lawmakers who listen to this show, but a gentleman says, what can I do? And I say, go get a radio show where you talk to a million people every day. He can't do that. But I know he can pick up the phone and call his state rep. What's wrong with that?
You're asking us to call. I called 12 of them.
Well, I called a million people. I've got you beat. If you're worried
you
about...
Yeah, you didn't call them directly, though.
I'm calling them out on the air.
I know that, but personally would be better, I think. I mean,
why?
It wouldn't take you much to call your two or three
Russ, how many hours a day do you work? How many hours a day do you work?
About two.
I work 13 to 14 hours every day, and last night I added on a four-and-a-half-hour car trip to Bellingham. I think I got you beat on that. And when you talk about using somebody else's time, it's always easy to use somebody else's time.
You're listening to the Lars Larson Show on FM News 101.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, I had no idea. A couple of hours ago, a young lady named Brandy called the show, and I appreciate her calling the show. But she explained to me that her problem was she was living on the street because she was forced to be on SSI disability because of back injuries that she had suffered that caused her a lot of pain. And she said, I can't really do a job. And I said, well, you're talking on the phone. And so this has inspired a number of people to call in because she said, if I go to work and earn any money at all, SSI will take away my disability, and then I have nothing to live on. And then we got the call from a gentleman in Puyallup, Washington, who works for Social Security. And he said, that's not true at all. We have a program called Ticket to Work. Now, I've heard of Ticket to Work before, but I've learned more about it today than I ever thought I would know. And he said, you're allowed if you're disabled. And I get a lot of people who call and say, well, I'm disabled, I can't work. Well, the fact is, you can. You need to find a job. And I was telling my producers about a young man. His sister Heather is somebody I knew through hunting, because she was one of the people we go hunting with in Eastern Oregon. And her brother took a bad fall and hit his neck on a piece of concrete and became either a paraplegic. I think he was a paraplegic rather than a quadriplegic. He finished college. He got a gainful job. He works. Now, then I hear from all these people who say the program will work for you. You can go out and work a job. You don't have to simply take disability. And if you're saying, I'll lose all of my benefits if I go to work, that is simply not true. So either you are uninformed, which is hard to believe, because if you're on SSI disability, you usually get to there by going to Social Security and saying, I need to be on disability, and they explain the programs to you. Now, if Social Security's program managers, the folks who talk to the clients, are not explaining Ticket to Work, then that's on the government, and that should be fixed. But if they are explaining it, but you say, oh, I don't want to work a job, then you're just lazy. Now, for example, Lauren writes into me, a young lady named Lauren. She said, Lars, I was on Social Security disability for 12 years due to a fall. I suffered severe injuries to both legs and my feet. I had to have one foot amputated after a four-year fight with bone infection. That sounds horrible, right? I mean, in some ways, you'd say, well, blame you if you don't feel like going back to work. You know what she said? I learned of the Ticket to Work program, and I took advantage. Social Security was very accommodating, and I didn't lose my benefits. I'm happy to announce, even with a prosthesis, you know, because she lost one of her feet, and residual pain in the other foot, I have been gainfully employed for 8 years, and I no longer need any government assistance. It comes down to how willing one is to fight to be self-sufficient. Ticket to Work does work. Now, I didn't even plan to talk about this program today, but I got the call from Brandy. I think that people should be encouraged to do the right thing. And to some extent, I think the system should become less generous. If the system says, this is a person who just doesn't want to work, I'm not interested in a taxpayer in subsidizing somebody who doesn't want to work. Now, if on the other hand, if somebody like Lauren, the young lady who wrote me the email, if she says, I want to work, but I need a wheelchair, or I need a special chair to sit in at work, or whatever. If we needed to get her a $500 chair so she can sit and do her job, if you needed to get her a telephone headset so she could do her job, if her boss needs to lower the level of her desk, as you know, employers are required to accommodate the physical disabilities of their workers. Now, we have all these laws and we have all these programs. If somebody says, well, I just don't want to do that, well, fine, you don't want to do it. We don't want to subsidize your existence if you've decided you just don't want to work. There are too many disabled people out there who go out, despite, like the gentleman who's putting in windshields. You know what it's like. You know, you go out and replace windshields for insurance companies or for an auto glass shop. Imagine this. He's got both of his legs broken from a three-story fall, and he hurts. I mean, you know that when you have that kind of injury, no matter how clever the surgeon is who puts you back together, you're gonna have some pains that the rest of us do not have probably for the rest of your life. That guy gets up and goes to work every day, and God bless him because his 11-year-old son gets to see Dad suffered the kind of injury that most people will never suffer, and Dad gets up and goes to work every day. Now imagine how valuable that is, not just to Dad, who's proud that he goes out and turns in a full day of work, but to his son, who sees that kind of example, instead of, my dad got hurt and just decided he didn't want to work anymore. What kind of example is that? Let's go to Mike in Goldendale, Washington. Hey, Mike, welcome to the Lars Larson Show today, live from KGMI Studios in Bellingham, Washington. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon, Lars. Early in the program, you mentioned the death penalty, which
yep.
I am in favor of.
So am I.
The argument of the anti-death penalty faction is, well, the convicted can always be given life without the possibility of parole. As far as I'm concerned, there is no such thing as without the possibility of parole. There is no guarantee that down the road, a judge will not grant a parole hearing or even commute the sentence.
Can I give you an actual example of that, Mike, that's going on right now?
Yes, I know what you're going to say, but go ahead, please.
Do you? Which one am I going to say?
Jeremy Christian.
No, I'm not talking about Jeremy Christian. Because you are right that if he is convicted of that terrible stabbing on the MAX train and killing two people and horribly wounding one, he is no longer eligible for true life in prison. He is no longer eligible for the death penalty. But I'm talking about something worse, because I'm talking about exactly what you mentioned. Because there are a number of people who were given true life sentences in prison in Oregon. And the voters had said, we want true life for some, life with parole for others, and the death penalty. And that's what the voters said. And just like in Washington, where the government is ignoring the directions of the voters, in Oregon, the state lawmakers last summer said, we're going to pass something to limit the death penalty. They really eliminated it. And they said, including Jennifer Williamson, the young lady who just decided to pull the plug on her Secretary of State run because she'd been spending her campaign money on fancy trips around the world. That woman stood right there in the legislature and said, this law is not retroactive. And that was a lie. She knew that it was retroactive, and the retroactivity has now started to kick in. People who had been sentenced to true life in prison because of the change they made in that law are now no longer going to serve true life in prison. It is retroactive to sentences that have already been handed out to killers who've already been tried and sent off to prison. So what you're talking about isn't just theoretical, that someday somebody will, you know, be taken off of true life in prison and given parole or even released. There are killers in Oregon prison right now who are going to be released because of this change to the death penalty. And there are killers, accused killers, like Jeremy Christian, who are going to not get true life in prison because it's no longer eligible. It's no longer possible. And he will not face the death penalty, nor will he face true life in prison. And he hasn't even been tried yet. But you're absolutely right. There are cases right now where killers are going to get out early, who, you know, the public was told, and this is what my friend Josh Marquis calls truth in sentencing. If you tell the public this dirty dog went out and murdered a bunch of people and we're sending him to prison for life, so that's the alternative to the death penalty, the fact is they don't know. And the fact is right now we're watching people who are going to be released from prison. The public was told they'd be locked up for the rest of their lives, and that was a lie. It's not going to happen. Live from Bellingham, you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
Lars.
Welcome Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you. Glad to get your phone calls and emails. We're live today from my Bellingham, Washington affiliate, KGMI. And glad to be here. I'm speaking to a group tonight. And then I'll be heading back to the home studio for tomorrow's First Amendment Friday. I've noticed that now that the Democrats seem to be losing on everything, losing on the Mueller investigation, losing on the FBI investigations, losing on their effort at impeachment, they have reached back to say, what can we pull out of our trick bag next that we can go after the Republicans with? And they have reached all the way back to the 1970s. I mean, I'm an old guy, and the Equal Rights Amendment was first proposed when I was in, I wasn't quite in junior high, but I was in high school when it was first proposed. And at the time, a lot of folks said, why do we need this? We have equal rights because the Constitution affords everybody in America equal rights. But now the Democrats say, we want to revive the Equal Rights Amendment. There was an expiration date that was set 1982, set by Congress. But now the Democrat-controlled House says, we want to change the expiration date from 1982 and extend it just a little bit to current times. Thomas Jipping joins me now, who's deputy director at the Ed Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, and he's a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Thomas, good to have you back on the program.
Thanks for having me.
So tell me this. Do we need an equal rights amendment when we have so many, we have state constitutions, we have federal constitution, we have piles of state laws and federal laws and even local ordinances throughout America that all speak to making sure that men and women are treated equitably? Why are they bringing this up again, and what would it actually do?
Well, the answer to your first question is no, we don't. In fact, I listened to the House debate today before they voted on this resolution. And every example that was given by the proponents of the ERA as to, you know, the discrimination here or women are subject to this there, every single example that they used was already covered under one or more of the areas of law that you mentioned, federal or state constitutions or statutes and regulations. That issue, it goes back actually long before the 1970s. The ERA, they've been trying to add it to the Constitution since the 1920s. Oof. And the debate about whether we need it, and if we do, how can you prevent, you know, mischief? How can you prevent it from being used for other radical things? That debate's been going on since the very beginning.
Now, one of the theories that I've seen is that the reason the Democrats in particular want the EPA to be, or the ERA to be revived, first passed by Congress in 1972, is they say we're just looking for equal treatment. One theory is that they want it because they think they can use it to go after abortion laws in various states, that under an ERA, certain abortion restrictions in states would then become unconstitutional. Is there anything to that?
I think that's the central reason why they're doing it. And in fact, it could be used potentially to invalidate all abortion restrictions, including restrictions that the Supreme Court has upheld under the Roe versus Wade decision. In fact, we know a little bit more about it because there are state constitutions that have ERAs, and there are states in which the state ERA has been used to strike down abortion restrictions and to force public funding of abortion. So the abortion is the main reason why the ERA is being pushed today.
So, Thomas, I mean, the Democrats really, hypocrisy is their best friend, because they're going to say, we want the Equal Rights Amendment so that men and women are treated equally, and one of the primary things we want it for is so that little unborn girl babies can be exterminated.
Yeah, one of my favorite bumper stickers is equal rights for unborn women. And, you know, I listened to the debate today. Speaker Pelosi was on the floor saying that we needed this to move our nation toward the ideal that everyone is created equal. Well, she's one of the biggest advocates for inequality between people who are born and unborn, and the Equal Rights Amendment would make that a constitutional mandate.
I'm talking to Thomas Jipping from the Heritage Foundation. Now, let me get into the stuff you are the expert in, the legal side of this. So it takes three-fifths of the states It's three-fifths ratification, three-quarters of the states have to ratify. And the argument is we've got some states, I think Virginia just became one, but there have been a number of states that had previously ratified the old ERA, which is the one they want to use and extend the deadline on, and they've said, no, we've rescinded our ratification. How does that work? Does the can you rescind the ratification or not?
Well, it really isn't that complicated. People know what an expiration date is. You know, you can't buy milk past the expiration date. I mean, it isn't. Yeah. It's not that complicated. Congress, when it proposes an amendment, has the authority to set an expiration date, and that's what it did. It set a 7-year ratification deadline. If 38 states had not ratified by the end of that period, and then they extended it for 3 years, it died. I mean, it expired. And no more than 35 states did ratify, and as you mentioned, 5 of those states withdrew their ratification. I personally believe that states do have the authority to withdraw their ratification, at least until the final threshold is reached. But the bottom line is, and look, I'm a lawyer, but that means I'm not good at math, but 35 is less than 38. So by the expiration date, only 35 states had ratified, or 30 if you want to count the rescissions. That wasn't enough. That means that the ERA expired on June 30, 1982, more than 37 years ago. It's dead. If they want to make the ERA part of the Constitution, they have to start over.
And by the way, in the news reporting of this, they're referring to Virginia as the 38th state to ratify. So, this is an example of fake media where they're counting 38 states have ratified, even though if the reporters looked, they'd find 5 had rescinded the ratification. And, of course, the deadline ran out 37 years ago.
Sure.
So is it even fair to say that Virginia is the 38th state to ratify?
It is not. And, in fact, the last 3 states to ratify, Nevada in 2017, Illinois in 2018, and then Virginia this year, they claim to have ratified an amendment that doesn't exist. You can't ratify an amendment that isn't pending before the state. And how do we know that? Virginia's own deputy attorney general 25 years ago said, they issued an opinion that the ERA was no longer pending before the states and could not be ratified. So I don't know what the Virginia legislature did. They didn't ratify the ERA, and it's not going to be certified as having been ratified. Like I said, this is not difficult. There are arguments for and against the ERA. If you want to put it in the Constitution, you got to follow the rules. Democrats in the House, and in the Virginia legislature, for that matter, think that they can get away without following the rules because they know if they do follow the rules, they'll lose.
Yeah, but Thomas, remember, this is the same bunch that thought they could deliver an incomplete impeachment to the Senate and have them finish up the job. We just watched that happen. So apparently the rules, the Democrats' adage is we don't need no stinking rules. We make up the rules as we go along. Thomas, thanks so much. I appreciate the legal insights. That's Thomas Gipping from the Ed Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies and a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. In a moment on the Radio Northwest Network, we'll get our weekly illegal alien update from our friend David Cross, and I'll get to your phone calls and your emails. Live from Bellingham, it's the Lars Larson Show. Welcome Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday today, live from the studios of KGMI, our Radio Northwest affiliate in Bellingham, Washington. I'll get to our illegal alien update in just a moment, but I want to start first with David. David, you heard me mentioning life in prison without parole, which is always the promise made by folks who are opponents of the death penalty. By the way, opponents of the death penalty number about 30% of Americans. Those in favor of the death penalty number about 70% of Americans. But the opponents always say, well, you can get rid of the death penalty. We'll just lock people up for life. The fact is, people don't get locked up for life, and that's especially true here in the Pacific Northwest. What do you say?
I'd say that's not true, and why would you want it to be true? Why would you want to lock someone up for life with no chance to get out, give back to society, but continue to provide meals, shelter, and space?
Because of the nature of their crime? The answer to your question is because of the nature of their crime is such that we have said as a society, it's not just me saying it, it's the people, the voters, and through their representatives, the public has said there are certain people who commit certain crimes for which they should be incarcerated for the rest of their lives. And as far as contributing to society, tell me this. Ted Bundy's been gone a long time. He was put to death, but he committed some horrendous crimes, both in Washington and Florida and elsewhere. If he had been let out after a long, long prison sentence, what exactly would Ted Bundy or Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer, what could they possibly have contributed to society after they murdered so many people?
Nothing. And that is my point, is why keep them around if they've proven to not have any benefit or help?
The only reason I could see
them away from the public.
No,
but then you're going to keep them alive. But
no, I don't want to. No, hold on, hold on, hold on. Do you have any kids?
Oh, I've got four kids.
Okay. Now, do you have different levels of punishment for different offenses? When one of your kids does something wrong, no matter how old they are, there's one kind of wrong where they get a stern lecture and dad points.
And every then punishment should be fit the wrong. That's how it should be.
So we have to have a range of punishments, and the range goes from death penalty to life in prison without parole, to life in prison, and we might let you get paroled, to 5 years in prison, to probation, to a harshly worded letter. I mean, you could have that whole range for the same crimes. I mean, there are people who do kill folks and say they're doing something wrong, driving a car, whatever it is. They kill somebody, and they get a year or two in prison. So it's not an accident, because if it's an accident, they don't get any punishment at all, because we don't punish accidents. But if you've done something wrong, you were driving carelessly, and you kill somebody, many times those people get a year or two in prison, which I think is far too little. But that's one end of the range.
Right.
The other end of the range is life in prison without parole. So why would you keep them around? Two reasons. One, because the idiots in the legislature have eliminated the death penalty. Or two, the idiot in the governor's mansion has refused to enforce the death penalty. That applies to both Kate Brown and Jay Inslee. Or because the voters of your state have said, we don't want the death penalty, and they haven't done this yet, and the powers that be won't put it to a vote because they know what's going to happen. So that's the answer to your question, because you have to have a range of punishments. And on that note, I'll turn to our friend David Cross, who keeps an eye on illegal alien activities in the Northwest. David, I'm in Bellingham today. Where does your story of illegal alien wrongdoing come from today?
It comes from Washington County, Oregon, Lars. Cupertino Juarez Hernandez, age 34, was convicted and sentenced in January to multiple sex crimes against children, Lars. This is one of the worst cases I've ever seen. There were four young children that he sexually abused between their young years and their teenage years. Tanya Romaine says he's illegally in the country, and Cupertino Juarez Hernandez is going to be joining 108 other criminal aliens from Washington County already in the Oregon Department of Correction prison system.
So he's going to cost us a lot of money. We're going to provide him with three hots and a cot and medical care and college if he wants it and a GED if he wants it. We're going to provide all this for him after he's done these horrendous things in our community.
now, Lars. He was one of three individuals that were charged last year for sexually abusing a group of children. And there's his cohort, his brethren, is going to be also tried for this. So it's a sad story. Washington County has become number one in rape and sex abuse in the state, even over Marion County.
See, and you know that one of the ways they got to number one, not every rape was committed by an illegal alien, but if you, I mean, like it or not, and I hate to say it, but in every human society, I would imagine you find rape or sexual abuse or sexual mistreatment of people. We try to make sure that we have as little of it as possible. It's almost impossible to eliminate because there are psychopathic people in every human society, sad to say. But at least the community should only have to deal with the crimes that are going to be committed by some of their, if you have a population of several million people, sad to say, some of them are going to commit these crimes. But when you then, as a county, say we're going to be a sanctuary county in a sanctuary state, in a sanctuary region that's going to invite illegal aliens in who commit a disproportionate number of sexual crimes, I fault the leadership of the county and the state for saying we're going to adopt policies that allow illegal aliens to be in our state, in our county, and they are going to sexually abuse or rape members of your family, and you have to do it because we're more worried about political correctness than we are about protecting your family. And I apply that to every single public official who's ever voted on behalf of sanctuary status. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.